Hello and welcome to Changing the Record, the podcast brought to you by the Talking About My Generation news team, who are setting the record straight on growing older in Greater Manchester.
Couple with Carol is powered by TalkTalk's Future Fibre, which has now arrived here in Manchester. Future Fibre broadband is ultra-fast and ultra-reliable, and with speeds up to a whopping 900 megabit, it's fast enough to handle anything you throw at it. Plus, you can connect over 75 devices at once, so bye-bye fighting over the Wi-Fi. As if it couldn't get any better, Future Fibre plans now come with an Amazon Eero mesh router, so you get the latest in Wi-Fi 6 tech for free. To see if your postcode can get Future Fibre, search TalkTalk Future Fibre now.
Hello and welcome to another Cuppa with Carol podcast, sponsored by TalkTalk. Today I'm delighted to be speaking to a successful local author, Chris Sims, who has written a series of crime novels set in and around Manchester. Hi Chris, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for the invitation, it's a pleasure.
Well, I've read most of your books, I have to confess, before we start. Probably, hopefully, I won't show my ignorance by forgetting the plots, but it's been a little while since I read some of them. But you've been writing for quite a while, Chris. I mean, the obvious first question is, how did you get into writing?
Well, I came through what's known in the industry as the slush pile, i.e. just sending off blind sample chapters to agent, you know, without any prior contact and just crossing my fingers. So I went through several rejections, thanks but no thanks, snippets of advice from an occasional agent, but basically all of them saying no thank you to me until probably after about a year of trying, one of the agents I first sent a sample chapter to got back to me very unexpectedly and said, oh, we've just found this buried under a load of manuscripts and we really like the sound of it. Have you been signed? Which I hadn't been. So then I went and met them down in London and they took me on. So yes, I kind of went through very much the sort of novice route of not really knowing anyone in the industry or how to go about doing it. So just sending off things, crossing my fingers.
Right. And were you working alongside that at that time?
I was, yeah. I was working at that time as a freelance copywriter. So I've been working in the advertising industry for quite a few years and was just sort of harbouring this ambition of having a novel published. And I think it was, I just turned 30 and I think I decided if I don't do something about this plan of mine, it's never going to happen. So that's when I started sending off the sample chapters and trying to write the book in its entirety. But yes, I was working daytime as a copywriter.
And do you think, looking back now, so sorry, which year was that roughly?
That would be back to pretty much to the year 2000, the millennium. Yeah, okay. That was another thing spurring me on. Oh my God, I still haven't done this. Yeah.
And do you think it's a different process now or from your experience or, you know, obviously you're involved with other writers as well. Do you think it's you'd get the same sort of lucky break these days or do you think it's a different world?
Yeah, I think the days of submitting direct to certainly the big publishers is, I mean, that's long gone. And that was pretty much gone when I was trying to get in back in the year 2000. So I think all the big sort of traditional publishers are very hard now. If you haven't got an agent, then they don't want to know. But I think what has changed is this proliferation of smaller independent publishers who are keen to sign people direct. Certainly some of the ebook publishers, Joff Books, Book Couture, I think for a while now they've made it plain they'll happily accept manuscripts direct from authors or from agents. They're not fussed which. So I think in some ways there are other avenues have opened up whilst the more traditional routes I think have become ever more closed down, I think, for people who don't have a track record of publishing or aren't known in the media or whatever it might be.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because it, you know, it feels like a sort of different world. You see, hearing a lot of people going for self-publishing, or I suppose that covers a multitude of sins, really, doesn't it? But it's interesting to know that, you know, there are avenues in, because I think, you know, this idea that we all have a book in us.
Yes. <you know?
laughs> Which I think there's a lot of, you know, potential writers out there that, you know, are interested in that kind of thing and how you take that first step, I think.
Yes, yeah, and I do think everyone does have a book in them. It's another matter getting it all down on paper at some stage. But yes, and as you just mentioned, the self-publishing world, you know, has really flourished, and perhaps in some ways has flourished too much, because it's become very competitive now amongst the self-publishing community. I'm not saying self-publishing authors work against each other in competition, but just the sheer number of self-published books out there makes it harder for you to stand out, which again, you know, rewind 5-10 years, it was a much less crowded market, I think, if you were indie publishing or self-publishing, whichever way you want to call it.
And I suppose this proliferation of Kindles, you know, people can just click in. I guess that also impacts quite heavily on how much you earn from writing these days. Is that fair to say?
Yep. But actually, this always surprises people when I tell them this. I count as a hybrid author. So I do still have a traditional publishing deal, but I also publish my own books direct onto Amazon. And so I've got a foot in both camps. And as an author, they're far more profitable for you to be self-publishing than it is to be going through a traditional publisher, because the royalties are so much larger. Each time one of your self-published books are purchased or downloaded or whatever, you get a far larger slice of that cover price than you get when a traditionally published book of yours is bought from Waterstones or WH Smiths or whatever. So yeah, it's interesting. Everything's up in the air. It's, you know, everything's being shaken up, I think, by the way Amazon cracked open the publishing market with the Kindle.
Right. I suppose, yeah, it makes you immediately available to loads of people, as opposed to having to go cap in hand to all the bookshops to stock you.
Yes. Yeah. And choosing to be, you know, exclusive to Amazon, which I've made that decision. I think they kind of account for 80% of the ebook market, or whether you also make your books available on the other devices like Kobo and Nook and Apple Books. Yeah. So you've got lots of options and you have to make these decisions. What's going to work best for you? So, yes, there's lots of things to try and take into account with the industry now.
Okay, so going back to your first book, or your first two books, I think was Outside the White Lines.
That was the first one, yes, yeah.
And was that followed by Pecking Order?
Correct, yes, yes.
And they're quite different in tone and content from your John Spicer series, aren't they? I think that's fair to say. Was that because they were kind of standalone stories, or...
Yeah, a bit of both, really. So there's some history behind that. Were those my sort of first two ideas, viable ideas for books? And to be honest, when I was writing those, I was very unaware of the whole sort of existence of different genres. And I mean, I was very ignorant of crime as a genre in itself, and who the big authors were, all that sort of thing. In my mind, I was just writing a sort of dark psychological thriller that might sit along the likes of, I don't know, The Wasp Factory by Ian Banks, or, I don't know, The Collector by John Fowles. Just kind of generic, you know, that I guess they fall within the crime genre. But I thought of them more as dark psychological thrillers. And then it was sort of swiftly explained to me, you know, you are within the crime genre. So that then the publisher who published those didn't like the idea for my third novel. So we approached a different publisher with that idea, and they very much liked it. And that was more of a kind of police thriller. And that publisher said, could you make this into a series? We're very much looking for a detective series in Manchester. So I thought it through and thought, yeah, I don't see why not. So the D.I. Spicer series was sort of born from that, really. And it started off with two books and then another two books, and it's now on 9 in
total. So I'm interested that Manchester came second, as it were, the decision to set it in Manchester. Was you're not local?
No, I'm from birth. that's right. I'm born and brought up down in Sussex. Yeah, it's my wife who's from the area. We live just on the outskirts south of Manchester. So yes, I sort of very much see the city through a outsider's eyes, although perhaps a bit less so now I've been here for over 20 years. But certainly when I first moved up here, it was a, you know, an incredible city for all the sort of the remnants of heavy industry and all the industrial heritage. So that was fascinating for me, coming from a very kind of quiet rural part of Sussex. But yes, I think the publisher were looking at it with a kind of one eye on the commercial thing, and they wanted a strong detective thriller using Manchester as its base. And yes, and then I'd happen to set, you know, essentially a detective thriller in Manchester. So yes, I sort of thought it through and thought, well, actually, there are so many ways I can use the city within the plots of future books. So we gave it a go and it worked out okay.
I think that's what's quite nice writing them, that there is a sense of place in them. How about the character of John? Mm. Is he based on anyone that you know, or is he kind of amalgamation, or would you rather not say?
Yeah, he takes certain elements of various people. Yes, I know. And I mean, I've always played rugby, and wherever I've lived, I've kind of joined a local rugby team. So when I came up to Manchester, the same thing. In those days, I was playing at Stockport, and you get quite a lot of policemen playing rugby as well. So there was quite a few people I'd come across who I was able to take elements of them and kind of roll them in to create John, who is a rugby playing policeman, and he's a bit overly physical, sees things very much as right and wrong and black and white. And yeah, and then obviously that occasionally gets him into trouble with his seniors in the Greater Manchester Police, because he's a little bit too physical at times.
You said you're up to book 9. Do you plan any more for him? I do.
There was never an intention to kind of let him fall away. Obviously, I've branched out in a few other directions, but the intention is always to come back periodically and write another Spicer and sort of keep adding to them. But I also like, if another idea pops into my head that definitely isn't a sort of Spicer plot, then I like to put Spicer aside for a novel and then write one of these other ones I've been doing. But no, he'll bubble along in the background, definitely. Miraxi not getting too much older, so he can he can still chase people through the streets and all that sort of stuff.
And so, interested from a writing perspective, so do you find that you kind of look at the world in a different way with your John Spicer hat on, if you like? Do you find it easy to sort of go back into that way of writing?
Yeah. I think with him, he is a character. He is so well established now in my head, you know, having kind of written him now for scarily getting on for 20 years. So yes, I mean, people sort of talk about, you know, I've heard other authors saying about how the characters kind of come alive in their head and start writing their own dialogue. And I am at that stage with Spicer. I know how he'll speak, but sometimes in a scene, you know, I tend to plot each chapter out. So I know pretty much where they're going. And sometimes with the Spicer novels, a line I completely hadn't considered will come out of Spicer's mouth, and that will take the chapter off in a direction I hadn't thought about, which is quite odd when you think about that, really, because it's kind of, well, who's writing it then? If you're not writing it, who is? But obviously, I don't know, subconscious comes through at some level. And yeah, and he says things which I hadn't planned at all.
Oh. Sort of like a ventriloquist dummy. That sounds a bit creepy.
It is very mysterious how it works. And I remember first reading other authors saying about how their characters just take on a life of their own with their dialogue, and thinking, really? Does that really happen? But no, I can vouch for that. I think when you reach that certain level of knowledge of the character, then they do kind of come alive in your head and become a bit independent.
Oh, that's interesting, because you then went on to do Iona Khan, to invent her, or however you want to put it. Interesting that you chose a female. Was that a conscious thing, or?
Yeah, it was conscious in as far as what I wanted to do was kind of try and write pretty much the polar opposite to John. So John being kind of 6'4", burly, as I say, great big sort of rugby player with a bust up nose and scars in his eyebrow and stuff like that. So a kind of 5'4", female, mixed race detective was pretty much as far as I could imagine away from John. So yes, that's how she came to be, really, was just, what's the polar opposite to John Spicer? And let's have a go at writing a couple of novels from that kind of a perspective, which was good fun, because obviously she can't physically intimidate people and bring that kind of physicality to a situation that John can and does. So she has to, think very much on her feet and, you know, try and resolve things through the power of her quick thinking, I guess.
I think there's two Iona Khan.
Yeah, there's two where she is the lead character, and then she actually joins John in the later Spicer novels 8 and 9 of the Spicer series. Iona Khan features in those alongside John. They actually pair up in the 8th Spicer novel, that they form a detective partnership for that particular novel. So yeah, she kind of got folded into the Spicer series.
Right. Well, yes, because I was just thinking back. I'm not entirely sure that I've read nine. I think I've read up to eight.
Death games. They have reason to believe some kind of terrorist incident is being planned that might involve a member of the royal family. Yeah. And then they're kind of in a race against time to try and stop it. Because Iona Khan is in the counter-terrorism unit of Greater Manchester Police. And John was always in the serious crimes unit, which was effectively the murder squad. And then John, being John, annoyed his bosses. So he got kicked out of the serious crimes unit and got taken on by the counter-terrorism unit. And that's how he got paired up with Iona Khan. So it's a kind of terrorism, kind of assassination plot, essentially. It was Death Games.
So, do you have
But
insider knowledge?
yeah, I mean, I mentioned earlier on, I know through having played rugby, I'm too old for it now, but yeah, so lots of the people I played with are still in the force or approaching retirement. In fact, a couple have retired now. So yes, I've probably four or five people I can tap up for information if and when I need it. One's a traffic officer, one's in the firearms unit. One was a kind of sergeant just on the beat in central Manchester. So, yeah, I'm able to, if I need particular bits of information, I generally can get it from those contacts who always say, never mention me in the acknowledgements. But yeah, what do you need to know? So, yeah, I can
Oh,
get.
interesting. And do you have to keep abreast of changes with that kind of thing?
Yeah, not slavishly, but I do, I try to. For instance, the Serious Crimes Unit got renamed a few years ago. So, yeah, I try not to become too obsessive with the fine detail because I don't think most readers need to know. But, yeah, I do follow that.
Now, in addition to your writing, or as an extension of your writing, I suppose, maybe better to say, you're a member of the Crime Writers Association.
Yes, the good
Can you
old
tell us a bit about that?
EWA, yes. Well, it's a great organisation. I mean, it was set up initially as a kind of community for crime writers, but it's become so there's area chapters, and you can go, and meet up with the people in your area for lunches and things like that. Because writing, obviously, being a very lonely business, but it's become more kind of, what's the word? More keen to connect with readers in recent years. So it now has a kind of public-facing side of it called the Crime Readers Association, which is the CRA. And anyone who enjoys reading crime can subscribe to the Crime Readers Association, and you get updates on anything going on with CWA members, latest books, book signing tours, whatever it might be. Sometimes people promote discounts on their books, those sorts of things. So yeah, it's kind of modernized a lot over the years, the Crime Writers Association, to have this kind of arm to it, as I say, the Crime Readers Association. It's just a good organization. Obviously, they're the organization behind the Dagger Awards for, all sorts of categories of crime novels. So it's very good at promoting and supporting the whole crime writing genre.
And does it have lots of members?
The CWA has, I think it's between 600 and 700 members, and they're not all active. Quite a few people who've stopped actually writing, but they keep their membership just so they can remain part of that kind of community. So there's quite a few older writers who've taken a rest from writing, lots of younger ones coming through. Recently, the constitution was changed to admit self-published authors as well, which was a big thing because they couldn't decide on what criteria to allow self-published writers in. Should they have one book published or five books published, or how should it work? Anyway, they come up with a set of sort of criteria to admit self-published authors. So that's led to an uptick in membership. And then in terms of the Crime Readers Association, so people who just enjoy reading crime, I think there's around just under 12,000 subscribers to the newsletters. And I do this thing called Case Files, which is an online magazine. And every 2 months, just bring out this magazine that profiles new or forthcoming novels from members of the Crime Writers Association. So yeah, that goes out to about 11,500 people, I think, get that into their inboxes every other month.
All right. So if any of our listeners are keen crime readers, then they would do well
Yes.
to get involved, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's free to join. Yeah, it's just really to promote the crime writing genre. And it's very much British based. There are members from overseas, but I'd guess easily 90% of them are British crime writers.
you've been writing for, as you say, about 20 years now. Are there trends in the sort of crime writing that you can follow? Not really. Or is it just what people want to write about?
Yes, I think the publishers do their best to set up trends quite often. I think the crime writers themselves try to follow trends, but you occasionally hear in the press, you know, oh, the next thing for this summer is going to be domestic noir. You know, that was one recently. And all those girl on a train and girl in a window and girl on the whatever. So, you know, but I think it's the publishers almost kind of set these things up as, you know, like a kind of sales technique in a way. You know, let's whip up a bit of interest and press coverage about the fact we're all these books coming out with this particular theme. But I think most crime writers, unless they're being pushed into it by the publisher, just kind of write the type of book they'd like to read. And if that happens to be, you know, coincide with the latest trend that the publishing industry are talking about, then that's all well and good.
I mean, I must admit, I read and then saw the televised version of Holding by Graham Norton.
Yes.
I quite enjoyed that. I thought that was a little bit different. I don't know. I suppose it sits in the crime as such genre. I don't know. It's one of those kind of
rural Ireland, isn't it? It's for his own background.
That was quite interesting. And of course, Richard Osman has shone a lot. Have you managed to get him into the CWA yet?
No, he would be great if he did join, actually. Yes. I'm not sure. I'm trying to think of anyone I know who's in contact with him, and I'm not too sure. But yes, I mean, he'd be a great asset for the CWA, and being very British in his style of crime writing. There's obviously people like Anne Cleves, you know, who's behind the Shetland series and the what's the other one? The lady detective also up on the Scottish Islands.
Oh, no, not Vera.
Vera.
Oh, yes. She's the Northumbria sort of thing.
Oh, is she? Sorry. So, yeah, and then Shetland's obviously the Scottish one. Yeah. So it's always nice when series of crime novels makes it onto the television or gets adapted onto the television and gets a wider audience that way.
Because I suppose it shines a light on crime writing in general, doesn't it? And, you know, sort of helps to promote what everyone does. People start looking around for new authors to read. And
absolutely. And all the Scandinavian stuff, that was a very big a few years ago, wasn't it? All the Scandi crime. And there are an amazing number of crime writers based in places like Iceland and Norway, and lots of them writing in English and all with amazingly long names, but which I can never pronounce. But yeah, there's no end of good quality crime coming from that part of the world.
In the nicest possible way. Yeah. Talking of crime writing, though, I sense you've got a bit of a shift to a different style these days. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I said, I'll be going back to Spicer probably the next novel. But yeah, I've got one in the pipeline, which is another standalone psychological thriller. That's with my agent at the moment. But that would sit alongside my very first two, Outside the White Lines and Pecking Order. So a kind of dark psychological thriller. But then prior to that, yes, I took a break from all the crime stuff to write a couple of supernatural thrillers, which kind of is my, I guess, in terms of my own reading, that's the sort of thing I've always really enjoyed from very sort of young ages, is sort of ghost stories and supernatural thrillers. I've always enjoyed reading those sorts of books. So yeah, I decided I'll have a go at writing a couple of those, which I did. So they exist in the world of Amazon as ebooks. I mean, you can get them in print as well, but I think most people download them for convenience and ease.
They're more short stories or novellas.
Yeah, there's two. I mean, yeah, and I have written a few short stories as well, both crime and sort of supernatural thrillers. Yeah, there's one called Sing Me to Sleep, which probably is a novella. That's, I think it's about 50,000 words, so a very short novel or quite a long novella. And then the other one is certainly much more novel length. That's probably 70,000 or just over that, which is called Dead Gorgeous. And I always struggled slightly with that one because it did have a different title initially, but then I changed it to Dead Gorgeous. So yeah, those are out there as well, which are a nice thing to add into the mix.
I'm interested to know, when it goes to the publisher, how much influence do they have over the finished article, as it were?
They can exert a lot of influence, yeah. Rewind the clock when we were initially talking about my first two novels, and then I began on that detective series. And I mentioned we moved publisher with that one because the publisher I was with, we showed them the idea for the third novel and they basically said, no, we don't like this. It's not right. Can you please come up with something else? Which I was a little bit offended by and a bit taken aback by. I didn't realize they could do that. So I had a word with my agent and she said, well, I know Orion are quite interested in you. So let's just show it to them and see what they say. And then Orion fortunately took that idea. So I moved to them. But that shows you the power a publisher has. They can, if they want, kibosh an idea and kill it off totally. But what normally happens is kind of a bit of horse trading, I think, between you and the editor. So they might suggest certain changes. You might take on board some of those, but other ones you'll argue your corner for that they stay in. So you have a bit of horse trading. But yes, I think authors need to be able to be edited. And if you're totally inflexible, then obviously you become very hard to work with from a publisher's point of view. And yeah, they won't offer you further deals. So yeah, you have to accept the fact what gets published might not be the book you had in mind necessarily. Not to say that's a worse book. Lots of editorial suggestions do improve a book, but it's for the author, it can always be a bit of a shock that you kind of find yourself having to take these changes on board.
I must admit, when I was working within the library service and talking to writers, I was absolutely amazed that editors can change poems.
Right. So I didn't know that. And I'm always in awe of poets because obviously you're writing with so few words. So yes, so the idea that an editor can be mucking around with your lines in a poem, God, yeah, that's more fundamental.
Yeah, absolutely. I was quite shocked that the lady was going through a deal with a publisher and was saying, oh, well, you know, she's changing this and she's changing that. And I was quite taken aback.
Thing is, you know, they are commercial enterprises. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so as much as publishers like to sort of say, oh, we're searching for new and original and fresh voices and the sort of thing they tend to have on their website, or we like to publish new, original, fresh voices. They will only publish the books they think are going to sell. So they'll do their best to make sure that that's the type of book that appears.
Yeah. And I suppose, you know, they know their business, don't they? And so you probably argue at your peril, really.
Yeah. And that's also a good point. You know, they, you know, certainly a senior editor's got many years experience behind them and a very, very close knowledge of the market, you know, which is always a horrible word to be thinking about from an author's point of view. But, you know, they appreciate what sells, what's going to be popular, you know, things not to include in a book. I always remember Val McDermid, her talking at a festival and saying, I learned to my cost never to harm an animal in a crime novel or any novel. You know, you do what you want to the humans, that's fine, but do not have gratuitous violence visited on an animal. And one of her earlier books had a scene where, you know, I think a dog or a cat met a grisly end and put no one wanted to buy it, or those who did buy it were really annoyed by it. So, you know, that was a kind of rookie mistake, I guess. And probably her editor should have said to her, we really shouldn't have this scene in this book because people do not like this sort of stuff.
But I suppose, yes, there are things that will put people off, and once they start, and now that reviews on Amazon or online generally, you know, are out there before the book's even out, I guess.
Yes.
You know, because you have people that get proof copies.
Yes.
Mindful, there's the word.
Mindful
of sensibilities.
Yes, and the speed of social media.
Well, certainly that. So where are you up to now? So you mentioned that you have a book with your publisher at the moment.
With my agent. And then we will kind of test the waters and see if anyone's interested in that in terms of if any publishers are interested in it. So yes, not sure what will happen there. You never quite know. If we draw a blank, I can self-publish it anyway. But it would be nice to have a publisher behind that one. And then I really do need to get in gear and get started on the next Spicer novel. That's what I should be doing. It's kind of hard when you've got a novel that hasn't kind of been signed off as such. It's quite hard to try and turn your mind to a new novel, but I probably shouldn't be sitting twiddling my thumbs waiting for my agent to get back to me about this current one and get going on the next one.
did you manage to write during lockdown, or did you, like me, get absolutely swamped by it and find yourself unable to write anything?
For me, I found lockdown was actually quite helpful in terms of, you know, getting words down onto paper. So yeah, it certainly didn't affect my, you know, volume of words I was getting down. I did agonize for a long time at the beginning of lockdown. That's when I was writing what is now the 9th Spicer novel, which is called Dark Angel. And that, by necessity of the plot, it did need to mention the whole COVID lockdown thing. And I was really flummoxed about how much to involve it and how big a part to give it in the plot. So yeah, that kind of seized me up for quite a while. But the novel got finished and I eventually resolved just to kind of allude to the COVID pandemic and lockdown just in very general terms, not getting too bogged down in specifics. And then since then, I've written this standalone thriller, as I say, which is parked up with my agent at the moment. So now I've pretty much kept to my novel a year sort of schedule for that. But people did find it very hard. And obviously you did as well, in terms of it acting as a kind of mental block for you.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I found it really stifling and very difficult to kind of find any positivity about anything. But I've started writing again now. Poems, it's under that. I do still harbour somewhere inside, I think, the thought that there could be a book there one day, maybe. Right. Well, on that note, I think I'll say thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. It's been a delight. I shall go back and read the 9th one, because I don't think I've read Dark Angel. So,
Yes, I think you'll like it. Lots of readers have said they enjoyed that one. Some of them have said that was the best one, actually. So there you go. You might be able to read.
Right. Oh, well, yes, I'm definitely going to go and sort out reading that. But as I say, it's a delight speaking to you.
Yeah.
You know, good luck with all your endeavours, whether they're supernatural or thrillers or John or.
Yeah.
As I say, he's become sort of part of our household as well now.
Oh, that's nice.
We've both read all your books. So as I say, now Dark Angel's the next one to go for. And we'll make sure that there's links to your website and to your books on the Talking About My Generation website. Thanks again and good luck for the future. And we'll look forward to seeing more from you and with a Manchester base, hopefully.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Carol. That was great.
Okay. Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
Today's episode of Cuppa with Carol has been powered by TalkTalk's Future Fibre, the UK's fastest and most reliable broadband technology, which is now available here in Manchester. Search TalkTalk Future Fibre to find out more.
Thank you for listening to our latest edition of the Changing the Record podcast. For all previous episodes and for the latest news, views and nostalgia for Greater Manchester, check out our website talkingaboutmygeneration.co.uk.